This is 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade, a retrospective podcast brought to you by UtilityMuffinLabs.com.
Welcome to another episode of 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Bob.
How are you today, Bob?
Doing great in this glorious Pollenville.
What are we doing today, Bob?
Today we're reviewing The Fall of London. V5 Fall of London, I'm going to add.
Yeah, Fall of London is a chronicle for Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition. But before we get into that, of course, I want to give thanks to our two new patrons since our last episode, Michael Hawkins and Loki K. And also today, Bob, I queried the Discord room to ask if anybody had any questions they'd like us to answer. And two of our listeners, Banality Bob, which is an amazing name, and Seidenvolk, which I have no idea what that means, but it sounds very German, asked what are some of the, they asked what are the top five books you must have for running V5, or alternately, the top five vampire books you like to have at your table anytime you run a game, even if they're not necessarily for that. And I would like to add a small addendum. I don't care what number, just books that you feel are necessary immediately to have on hand when you run a game.
All right, immediately, no matter the game, or is it just
we'll call it a vampire game, right? You sit down to play a vampire game. What are the books you bring to the table? Not necessarily your library, right? We've all got our little library or our iPad of books we can access readily, quickly, but like, what are things you want to have at your table, even if it's only one book? What are those essentials
for V5? It's the V5 main book.
That's weird. That's mine too.
To see, and for Vampire the Masquerade 20th, mm-hmm. It's the main book.
Yeah,
it's gonna shock you that a lot of mine are gonna have the main book.
Right, right.
That's people ask must haves, and that's really all you need.
Yeah.
Is that one book.
Right.
You don't need any others. The rest are just window dressing.
Right.
And or to be specific, not to just completely discard them, they're deep dives. How you should always do these games. I don't care what the role playing game is and what company made it. Is you should go with the main book. If you like the main book, then take an interest in their other products.
Right.
And if it's something that caught your eye from the main book, invest in that interest. That's right.
I also have a bit of an opinion on this that might surprise some people. I did make a list of books, main book being primary, like always want to have your, if you sit down to play, you should have the book. If you sit down to run, you should have the book. That's my opinion. Additionally, I do like to bring a city book if I'm running my game out of a city. You know, if it's a Chicago by Night, I want to have the most recent. The odd opinion that people might not necessarily understand, though, is if you're sitting down to run V5 or to play V5, I don't necessarily think you need to get any of the previous material to read. I think, in fact, at times that can be a distraction.
Take none of the previous material. V5 should be treated as its own dimension.
I truly believe that. I truly do.
Before, I used to think it was a continuation for V20. It's not. It's you're going to trip up if you think it is, because they fundamentally have changed so much. And what it is in V5 is to not even be considered the same product. Yeah.
I would go so far as to say that V5 is essentially a soft reboot. It's using the material from that as inspiration, because truly, even especially in this book, which we'll get to, that you'll recognize the names. But if you're an old hat at this game, it's going to seem so much different to you that it might be off-putting. I feel you should just put that stuff aside.
And here's the thing. We're saying this from experience, right? So the whole aspect is that when you try to... I tried to run a chronicle, in fact, on our Discord, that connects and syncs up with V5 events. They don't sync up. They have a timeline to say they do.
Right.
And when this goes, and to justify going forward. But then when you get their books they put out, they often contradict what the stated timeline was. And what I mean by contradict, like, you know, you'll have a certain series of events that allegedly occurred,
yeah,
but then never happens.
Right.
Right? And when you actually get the book. And what this is that I think when it was hot, when it came out, there's a lot of aspirations. and there were a lot of goals that were put down in the book by the creators and everything else. But then as money and things change and projects, you know, evolve and how this works in this industry, some people don't go with that direction.
Right.
And then it doesn't add up. So, but we, the players, should always have, you should never have a dead egg that, you know, you invested. Why are you screwed? Because they didn't go the direction of what you invested right. in. They right. went. And the answer is, it's simple. If you disconnect, V20 says you can tell an ongoing chronicle that will eventually, maybe, perhaps, have some of the events in V5 happen. Maybe.
Right.
And you should run it in a very gray and dark maybe, because the truth is, there's so much you can do from V20, you may never run a chronicle to catch V5. And right. that's okay. You may say, ignore V5, and I recommend that, and just run V20 to the modern, because it's easier for you. And there's a ton of stuff they did in V20, in particular from Beck and Shahad Diary, that I adore.
Yeah.
That I think that gives you a world of exploration. That continuation you're looking for is there. But when you get to V5, it's a new system. It's a new way to look at feeding. It's some cool stuff in it. Even the artwork adds a different feel to it. The focus is on the youth and has no elders at all in terms of that you recognize as right, being elders. Right. Right? And they've changed that dynamic, and right. the powers are different. And I've had so many questions from people going, why is it different? The only thing I could tell you is this. Ignore it.
Right.
They're different because it's like Requiem. Right? Requiem's still vampire. But the rules are different, right. the origins are different, but it's still a vampire. It's a different take. It's sort of, look at this as a what-if comic,
right.
if you're a fan of Marvel. And just kind of go, okay, cool. So someone said, we're going this direction, V5. Seems pretty cool. You know, enjoy the stuff for V5 for what V5 is. And that's my solid recommendation.
Yeah.
Because I will tell you right now, the easiest thing you can do, anyone can be a critic. Anyone. It's easy to focus on the negative. But anybody who's looking to get benefit from what they're doing will focus to the positive.
Right.
And if you don't have any positives, move on.
Right.
Don't
right.
say anything. Just move on.
That is definitely, yeah. I'll agree with you in that regard. I definitely feel like if your perception is that you're upset that they are not telling the story that you wanted them to tell, I mean, you're never going to enjoy V5 and what it has to offer. I think... if you are starting as a new player, if you are starting a new chronicle with new people, don't bog them down with the old lore, because they're going to come to the same conclusion that maybe you have, which is they can't make sense of it. Characters change so dramatically, are presented so differently in V5 that for a lot of us that have been doing it for a long time, we just don't connect. I think that's an error. Start the game fresh, like it's a new thing that's familiar to you.
And in that, you'll have people who want to play, you'll have people who are interested, and that's how you have to present it. And if you go to pitch it to your friends, don't tell them it's the continuation from V20, because you will be in some very awkward discussions right. later on down the road, right?
Right. right. Also, look at it from a perspective of a logistical perspective. What's easier to do? Go out and buy 155 Vampire the Masquerade books that Bob and I spent 2 years reviewing, or 5? To me, that's a no-brainer. You know, but of course, do you. So last thing I want to say before we get into the review, which this is a good segue to, but the last thing I personally always want at my table is a screen. I love having a screen. I like the sort of wall that it puts between the players and I. It allows me a sense of control. I can do things behind it that builds mystery. I have quick access to things. Personally, I know a lot of people that are just like, I could take it or leave it, but I enjoy having it. I like having a place where I can see quick access to things, and I've got one for every version of the game. So if I decide to play a first edition game, I don't know why, but if I decided to do that, I've got a screen. If I'm going to play V5, I've got a screen. There you go. And outside of that, you know, whatever else you need to run your game, an iPad, a computer, a notebook, that's what you should have.
And what I could tell you is, and with full confidence, if you were to somehow not use the screen, it would be because you're cheeky like me. And what happens is your players gain confidence when they point out rules calls to you, and they tell you you're wrong, right? But it's how they do it. See, that your players can learn, and this is a tip, your players need to have ownership of the same material you read. They can't have absolute trust and faith in you every time, otherwise they learn nothing.
Right.
And you gotta teach them to read for comprehension, to read to understand, and to be able to debate what they know, or maybe use it in a creative way. And that's okay and healthy. However, there's something they have to learn. Before your ego gets too big because you're a storyteller, you want them to poke at you. You want them to be like, hey, didn't I have to blow blood for Potence to work? So why is that NPC? Did he use blood? I didn't hear you say that. And as an ST, you can be like, well, I don't have to say it, but you're right, I did forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
When you start doing that, you told the player, hey, man, good looking out. You do know the rules. And man, I did forget. I'm human. I'm just like you. And right. Because of that, you note it and adjust it. And then they feel confident that they helped you tell a story. And before you know it, that player becomes a participant more so than other players versus just standing in the background. Now, where this gets dangerous, when you want to not be interrupted. Right?
Right.
So this is the catch you have to learn. Your players also have to learn to time their interruption, right? You don't want to do it in the middle of a dramatic scene. Like, imagine watching, Troy.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, Achilles drags the dead son up to the gates, and, you know, his cousin up to the gates or whatever, and I forget who he dragged. Somebody dragged up there.
He dragged somebody.
and they come walking out to get him, and that epic fight that was supposed to happen doesn't. Oh, I'm sorry. He was out there to fight a guy because his cousin was killed. That's what it was. But that fight. That's what I'm referring to.
Right. The tense, passionate moment. That almost proved your point. Right.
Exactly.
There. I thought it was a phone. I was like, wow, that's a loud phone.
No, that's a klaxon alarm.
That meant
someone was at the door and there was no one.
There was no one there.
Well, you know, it's an apartment. They probably hit the wrong one. Didn't want to feel like assholes.
The spirit's helping out.
Right. It was just the hand of fate going, watch me interrupt your podcast. This will be fun. All right.
But no, that was exactly my point, as you pointed out, no doubt. So,
well, I guess it's that time. The time you've all come to hear, the review you've come to hear, The Fall of London. Bob, tell me about The Fall of London, if you will, and I will be happy to jump in and assist you in that telling.
So, Fall of London is a chronicle that's told in a format that is going to be unique to a lot of people. It takes a bold direction. Instead of it being a typical outline, here's what you do, how you do it, here's what goes on, and blah, 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 and there is an element to that. It also uses memorandum, which is basically flashbacks. A lot to tell a tale.
Memoriam, I think it was.
Memoriam, that's it.
Sorry.
Memoriam, memorandum, memorandum. Basically, flashbacks is what it means.
Right.
And the point of it is that it's a storytelling technique. I know that's why they mentioned it. It was in their storyteller's handbook to have it, and that's the deal. That's the long and short of it.
Right.
So, aside from that,
mm-hmm.
The main importance of this is the storyteller has to know the entire backbone of what's going on in London. Long story short, Mithras's return.
Right.
This may strike you as weird. Right. Because none of you knew Mithras was gone. We all know Monty Coven. We all know the situation. We all know Diablerie happened and took place and, you know, like werewolf bombing, blah, blah, blah. And Monty seized the prize. And then we learn in Becca Shahad's diary, Monty had plans.
Right.
He was moving and grooving to his own tune. And you're going to think to yourself, much like we thought, well, that's the connection.
Right.
This is going to be a story about him making moves in London. And it is. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Note that. Of sorts. Yes.
Right. However, this is also a unique author's take of what could happen. And unfortunately, and this is where my anecdotal is going to kick in. As I read it, I felt that there were fundamental things I wouldn't have done. But it is holding true to that story. It is a deep plot by Mithras to regain power, to seize a very different look of what London is, even almost wresting it from Camarilla control.
Right.
Right? Total freedom back to the way it used to be. Now, let's talk about the axe real quick, because I think now that you know the overarching story, it'll make a little more sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of get on this strange trip we're about to go.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, too, another thing that is kind of unique about this in the way that it's presented is it's not just your players sit down and make characters. There are pre-made characters that are part of this Mithric Mysteries cult.
Right.
And they underwent a ritual some 70 years ago and were put into torpor so that at a later time when needed, they could be awoken Lots of ritual magic. It's all explained. It's all right here. Your characters awaken without any real memories of who they are. They still know their skills. They just don't remember their past. And then it goes from there.
They're in torpor for 70 years. And that's the point of it. But remember, this is the Mithraic cult. This is a cult of the bull god, a warrior's cult.
Yes.
And this isn't unusual. They have a picture in the book early on that shows you exactly the players being put in to their torpid state. And it's a very cool picture.
Yeah.
I mean, just looking at it, hell yeah, that's awesome. We're in a good place, right, for this story. Definitely resonates what a cult is, what's going on, and, you know, who they are. Now, what happens from here, though, is something that can throw a lot of folks off, and it threw me off especially. When you start thinking of, you know, Monty Coven and whatnot, and there's a photo of him right after that Mithraic cult, torpid thing, there's Monty Coven in a nice suit where it shows Mithras above him and sort of a weird I control the reins thing going on.
Right, like a specter of Mithras's identity above him, controlling him.
Now, here's an assumption this book makes, is that you, the reader, or the buyer, have a clue, the faintest clue, of what Diablo is about. Right?
Right, right.
It assumes you've been in Vampyr long enough to know it. And here's the thing. V5, a lot of its fans are new to Vampyr.
Yes.
This is my contention with it. They're new to Vampyr, and you're pulling on old material to inspire and explain, and it could get convoluted, and yeah. often does. Yeah. And so this book assumes you understand at all why Monty Coven exists or the Diabri occurred, and it definitely explains that this process happened, but they don't quite get into what it is. They just tell you Diabri. As far as you know, it could be a spiritual power.
Right.
Right? Monty Coven went to Mithras and Diabri'd him and gained his powers and moved on, but Mithras turned around and actually Diabri'd him.
Right.
And thus has power, but not his full power.
Well, not to interrupt you, but like it goes into also kind of like really focusing on this Mithras as a god thing, right? And more so a god of the sun than a warrior god that we were presented. That too may throw some people off and make them go, wait, what? Like, is he a god? Is he a vampire?
It can't throw him off, and here's why. And I'm going to tell you, if you look up a Mithraic cult and you read what it's about, the god is a warrior god and of the sun and of the bull. These are things that it represents. And like any god, it's open to the religion's interpretation.
Sure.
And so that's where it starts blending with World of Darkness. You've got to remember that, right? There's a lot. Like, this isn't a book about Mithraic cults.
Right.
Right? It's in here that there is a cult to do it, but it is not that. So remember, it's telling stories. So, if we're still with that, what Diabri is, and we all, hopefully, all our listeners know because we've talked about it, it is when a vampire devours another vampire's soul.
Right.
Right? Done so by, of course, you drain all their blood, and then the epic willpower struggle starts. Now, for the record, if I haven't stated it, I think Diabri is the dumbest thing this game ever had.
No, it's I don't think you've ever stated it.
It's the most ridiculous mechanic I've ever read in my life for any game. It promotes... It doesn't even give the mystique they thought it would. I'm gonna leave that there.
Fair enough.
Right?
Fair enough.
It's because what you're trying to say is that the youth can steal the ages of power from an elder, and the elder should fear the youth from it. When it's more fearful if they just came in and torture Haven while you're still sleeping. Right? The loss of everything. Your death is still the loss of everything.
I can,
if your soul is annihilated.
I can understand that. But I think it is a consistent theme throughout the entirety of the game.
It is, and it's stupid. So we'll go with that. It's completely moronic. Think of it. Diabri Mexico.
Right.
Right? Think of every Diabri book they put out, and everyone was like, oh, it's cool. Is it? The majority were like, well, why would I even bother if there's a risk that my soul could get taken over?
It certainly does promote the concept of, like, hunting down for power. Yeah, I get that.
It's ridiculous. Guess what? You're immortal, and a neonate today in 4020 is going to be a badass. In other words, focus on the fact that age brings power, right?
Sure,
it's
sure.
that simple.
Sure,
it doesn't. You can't shortcut it. There's no shortcut to it. That is what it is. There will be opportunities to climb and get temporal power, of course, right? There's ways you could do that and create that for yourself, but you have to seize those opportunities and create them. However, not this book. My personal bullshit aside, Diabri is a thing. You devour another soul, and you can get possessed by it. Now. Right. Why? It's going to be confused to you, because let me get a lot of the questions I had in my head if I were brand new looking at this book, right? I just read Diabri, so apparently vampires aren't immortal, and they're not dead? I mean, it's weird. Like, they're dead, but not undead? Well, because your spirit, if it could transfer, if I could steal your soul into mine, how does that work? Like, what sense does that make? And you're sitting there thinking correctly that's baffling what's going on. And then they're just going to tell you, magic!
Right, right.
And you got to have cognitive dissonance to this. Because it's just a mechanic they threw in.
Because Mithras is so powerful and so old and so et cetera, that he just is able to take over as if he, like, that is still a function of the soul.
But let's use scientific logic. If that's the case, then why didn't Monty Coven just die tried and Mithras stand back up after taking his blood himself?
Yeah, it creates this confusing battle between the two entities, between the two spirits of the individuals.
You want to talk? It's predator based, is what I think. And if I go to Diablo as a stronger predator, that predator's beast is going to seek to devour my own. That's how you need to look at it. Not even in the spiritual sense, because to me, Monty should have just reduced to ash, and all his blood went to Mithras, and he stood up and limped away. And everyone else should have been like, okay, that dude is as old as. Or whatever. That would make more sense. But that didn't happen.
No.
Monty swallows the big chunk, as I'm going to refer to it. He takes the whole elephant. He never heard of the only way to chew through an elephant is one bite at a time. Right. He decides to swallow the whole elephant and ride it out and see what happens. Well, little did he know that our little elephant Mithras can fly. And there's a lot that comes with that, right? So it starts off small. There's, as the Aubrey will tell you, it's quirks initially. It's your memories smashing together. And if Monty didn't have as much of a life as Mithras did, a lot of Monty's thoughts are being annihilated as he's in the body. Why? It's easier to remember someone. Why do we look at stars and the rich and royalty? They live a life far greater than we can imagine. And we heap up and hype up what their life is like, right? I promise you, Tom Cruise wakes up every day having a shit. I promise you.
What?
Right. What I'm telling you is that people don't think like that. Right. They don't make them human, right? It's they never have these weird problems. They never have these weird situations. And when you do that, you lose them, right? I mean, you put them on a pedestal and there's something completely different. This is exactly what happens when you take greater memories than your own. If your whole life is basic by comparison to this person's life, yet you've devoured their soul in it and your mind's battling as to what is you and who is them, you're going to lose to that greater entity as you start convincing yourself and opening yourself up to its control.
And that's pretty consistent with the world as it's been established.
And it's simple, right? Well, now that you know that that's average, and by the way, BJD told you about all that. His weird personality quirks, him being in the Sabbat, making weird orders and killing certain members and taking control and being in London and being a problem.
Yeah.
It more or less picks up from there, right?
Right.
Now, here's where we completely throw it for a loop. In this book, there's a ritual that was made to justify this book.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's absolutely true. That was the very first thing that we see is called the ritual of transferring the soul. And it's really, reading through this and kind of like getting my thoughts in order, I was like, this ritual seems to only exist because it's a plot device for the story. I don't recall any previous indication of this ritual being present in any of the earlier things, any of the earlier supplements, books, versions, etc. And I was like, I kind of have a bit of an issue with this ritual that seems so placed intentionally.
And it's one of those things that will derail you if you're, again, an old hat. Not even that. If you just bought, we had a couple people who just recently got the books and we're kind of following on with the pod and we're asking questions about rituals and rites and thaumaturgy, where it comes from. And after me explaining to him how cool Thaum is, and later on it becomes blood sorcery in V5 because we needed a basic category for every reason. And that's what it, like the Way of Miracles is much cooler in my opinion.
I don't understand why they were like, it's thaumaturgy is not a thing anymore. Now it's blood sorcery.
But it's okay. So we're over here now and it's the only way to do it. Cognitive dissonance. All right. So I'm just laughing too much. So basically, just what it is the point of this ritual, as I will get off that tangent, is it's to explain and justify Mithras regaining his full power while in Monty. As you know, just because Mithras regains Monty's body, let's remember Diabri. Diabri does what? It lowers your gen, right?
Yes.
Immediately, by one step. If they're of lower gen than you, If I'm 13th and I deodorize someone who's 12th, I become 12th.
Right.
I steal their power. Your power, your soul is mine. That's how it works, right? Hopefully, you're not a 4,000-year-old 12th gen.
Right.
Because what shitty person lineage were you part of that happened, right?
I don't know. A very, very thin one.
But you're a 12th gen with fives everywhere. I guarantee it. Anyway, let's put this in perspective. So Mithras was 4th.
Right.
Right? That means his housing, his potency, his blood, his age was immense. And Monty was probably around, what, 10th, 11th, whatever he was. I didn't even bother looking it up because I didn't really care that much.
Yeah,
so.
It plays 0 point in this particular book. So,
but if you diabolize someone with that much of a generation gap, the potential to lower up to 3, the book recommends, gens is possible. But it has to be an extreme disparity, just like that.
Right.
Right? So if he was around 10th or 11th, and old boy is 4th, yeah, there's a chance to jump. Now, this becomes interesting. Because if that's the case, and he lowered, well, he's 8th gen now, right, let's just say,
right.
By mechanic, by their own Diablo mechanic, well, he's not at full power.
Right.
He can't be.
Right.
And he will never obtain the power he had. However, you have to understand, V5 does not acknowledge powers over 5.
Right, right, it doesn't.
It throws them out the window. So they needed to invent a mechanic that could explain his increase in power.
Right, right. His blood potency, his generation, his increase of power. Because the rest of it doesn't really matter.
And it doesn't even matter by V5 standards. Now explain why. If you look at the mechanic for V5 and the points you can accrue from Diablerie, well, that's a huge chance for good old Monty to gain quite a bit from where he's at. But still, it's not Mithras' full power.
Right.
And that's what this is about. The real gamble is Mithras to gain full 4th gen again.
Right.
Without having an antediluvian in, right? Cognitive dissonance. We're just going to throw that.
Yeah.
At least I am.
Yeah. that was exactly the kind of this was going on. This conflict was occurring as I was reading this, where I was like, so I didn't want to like get overly aggressive about it, but I'm
sure.
I'm like, you're doing a hunt for 5 different items. It's a scavenger hunt so that Mithras can go back to being the powerful elder he was, also to justify Decamden's generational, which is a whole other thing I don't even want to get into.
But hang on. Got to remember, when V5 came out, what was said was the Second Inquisition hunts down and chops off and shoots Queen Anne to God's End, and she's, like, killed in the streets. They just hunt her down and smoke her, right? Because they knew all about her.
Right.
Well, this book starts off saying it's all about Mithras and him regaining his glory.
Right.
And, okay, all right, so let's stick with that. Because if you're me, that's why I got the book, was to hear that story. Now, all right, so Mithras has a weird ritual. This really should be a subplot, maybe something thrown on the back burner, but you, the ST, have to know it off the bat. That's the goal.
Right.
All
right,
there are 5 items that are needed in this ritual, and they have to be infused with the essence of the person who you're trying to use the ritual on. Now, strangely, because Mithras is the bull god and has been around for quite some time,
right,
he happens to have only 5 items. Now, I want to state this again.
Uh-huh.
Thousands of years he's lived. Thousands.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. He's had a cult forever and a day, and he doesn't have a loyal guard. He doesn't have loyal retinue of ready, able acolytes that were all older than 70.
Right, right. I was going to say, he does, but there are these guys right here that he's...
that didn't hold more items than just 5? Like, if I knew this ritual existed and I were Mithras, even if I didn't know it, and I'm Camden who made the ritual, we will get into that. Let's look at the aspect of, all right, Mithras has to have, well, there has to be a bull.
Right.
And because it's not like there was one temple for the entire cult.
No.
In fact,
there isn't even just one cult.
Right.
There are many, many cults.
To this guy.
Right.
Like that he went around to, right? We're talking about a guy who allegedly learned thaumaturgy from Hakim. Right. He sat and worked with cognitive dissonance, and so he has 5 items that were used to infuse for the story
yep.
to move on. and use that for the plot. So of these items, five individuals each got one item apiece. And it's up to the players who are now being reawoken to come and serve in this capacity. Now, we have to go back to, well, where'd this ritual come from? And if Mithras made it, why didn't he have more stopgaps and failsafes? Well, he didn't. Turns out he has a lover. Yes. And his lover is Roger de Canman, and he truly loves him.
Best friend and lover.
Now, it's weird. It's weird because Roger de Camden hasn't had much focus, right?
Right.
He was always that guy that just was in London and served Mithras loyally.
Cappadocian.
And he was there. But with an obvious reason. Anybody who ever read that went, oh, the sole reason this Cappadocian is alive in canon is because Mithras said no.
Right.
Right? The Giovanni can't come in to kill this cat and diabolize him because they have to contend with a very powerful Camarilla in, honestly, what was the gemstone of the Camarilla. It wasn't Chicago. It was London. It was the untakeable power that the Ventru had established here in Europe, in London, Germany, and all that, and kind of had this lockstep, but this was the focus. So, okay, the Giovanni say you get one.
Right.
Right, and that's Camden. Well, cognitive dissonance. In V5, Roger de Camden actually was a staunch student in studies of the Hakata and all sorts of Oblivion arts.
Yeah.
And permitted him to create a ritual that, quite frankly, allowed him to ditch the Giovanni persecution. How he did it? Found a guy, some dude, and performed this ritual on him and transferred his essence after his, come diabolize me. I did the ritual already. I instantly take you over and have all my power again. I just look different. I know what you're thinking. It's in your head. I could feel you thinking this. Why not just learn obfuscate?
Yeah, right. Well, right? Maybe they were tracking his soul.
I know what else you're thinking. Why not get vicissitude, just change your body? And since you know such arts, you can defunct a simple casual auspex look. Why not do that? That'd be a lot less effort, a lot less need to make a ritual in a book for a crime. Cognitive dissonance. You see, in V5, we don't know if the Sabbat are ever going to exist, and therefore, there are no working rules for vicissitude, and we don't even want to allude to that, to allow the authors who continue that story in V5 a chance to tell that tale, if ever.
Nor do we want to get into, the potential for the character to have maybe gone to the Shadowlands or to do any number of other things, or perhaps just hang out with Mithras, his good buddy, best friend, in the 1500s, and just not get killed by the Giovanni. But we have to bring this character back. It's the linchpin to why this ritual even exists. It is a thing. It is totally.
It is
awesome.
What it is.
Yep.
And there's just maybe plot holes if you look too hard. Don't. So when we move on and we start discovering that the chapters don't have to be done in order.
Right.
Right. They definitely recommend the first one be the Awakening.
No, right? I read it in order, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I did too. But you could do the Awakening. Here's why you do the Awakening. Well, actually, let's not even jump, because in order what they had it rolled out, you start with knowing what the ritual is and what the story is about. Then it gets to Antigen, Project Antigen. This is a hard thing to read, not because it was written poorly, not because it wasn't thought out as how it could be something, but because you're trying to play a game called Vampire.
Right.
And you're trying to swallow how these potent, elder-like people in London, who are the Camarilla, which do control these elements and have for some time, suddenly don't have the control at all to see a forming hunter cult amidst all these other organizations. And they have excuses, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Unbeknownst to a lot of people, Monty Coven, Mithras, apparently drops the bomb about all the Elysia. And that's the various Elysiums approved by the prince.
Yep.
All throughout Avalon, his territory, and especially where the Anarchs dwell.
Right.
And he wants them done in. And so he wants Antigen to handle it because, for whatever reason, Mithras wants them all gone.
Right.
Not just any, he wants a new start. As he, I believe later on, quotes, "We will rebuild as Rome once had to rebuild."
Right.
That was just, he's totally cool.
He makes the decision to basically give a massive leak of epic proportion, a breach of the masquerade unlike any that has been presented in print before, and give it to a group of hunters that have somehow formed a conspiracy against the vampiric denizens of London. He gives them this information, and the information that he gives proves to be true and accurate. And from that point, Operation Antigen grows and blooms into this massive, sweeping, mortal conspiracy against vampires.
And it's that simple, right? That's what goes on. Now, I like to take a note also here as you're reading about Antigen. Actually, I won't do that yet. But the other Antigen problem is the formation of Antigen,
mm-hmm.
right? I won't get too specific, but because really it's a lot of explanation when the general gist of it is really what you're going to care about. And you could probably do your own take on how this happens, but the understanding is that someone encounters one of these blank bodies, right? And several times there's evidence that stacks up and certain organizations already knew about them. Now they cite a group in here, and to never be cited again, Arcanum.
Yeah.
Right? They exist neutrally. Arcanum Head is a group of mortals who've been studying the Supernal and collecting all sorts of artifacts and books.
For centuries. Or decades, rather.
Scholarly duty.
Right.
And honestly, I think that group came about because Highlander had a group that did the same thing. And Highlander, the TV show. And they always remark, they're so identical, It's cool they're there, though. It's not a bad thing. It's just, all right,
it's kind of like,
take on what you could do.
If you're into Supernatural, it's basically the Men of Letters.
Right. It's the same deal. Same deal. And but anyway, what happens is that they justify them existing as the potential leak source that could have... They don't ever attach it, but they're like, well, these guys exist. So now you understand that the government knew about it, too. However, I've heard a lot about, you know, British government, understanding how they operate and how they work, and they do want to protect the masses from the unknown, like any government.
Yeah.
However, they may go to an extreme, right? They do it for the protection of their people of the utmost, and of course, the crown. Now, if the crown knew that vampires existed, and that's what I wanted to read in Project Antigen, I wanted to read how the SAS goes to town, how they get repurposed in the name of the queen to make sure her and her line are defended.
Right.
And they go on a purge, how they go to find out all these people in here and tell a better, stronger story about how London responds when someone finds out. When royalty finds out someone's trying to undermine who they are, you're not just undermining that royal family, you're undermining a nation.
Right.
That comes with dire consequences. And I was waiting for that level of it. And it's not that. It's not that at all.
No, it's really one small group within the Met that is able to, through various means that are presented here, they're able to operate with impunity, basically hunting down and destroying vampires, utilizing all of the other branches of the government without those branches really being aware of what they're doing under the guise of anti-terrorism.
Now, as they said, the government, or rather the crown, that whole nine, Parliament even knows about it. Parliament just ignores it. That's right. How they handle it. We'll just leave that alone. Doesn't affect us. And that's more or less what the stance is. And they leave everyone else to kind of fend for himself. And they have some key figures in here, too, to kind of highlight what we're talking about. That, okay, great. Antigen exists. And so what you're saying is you're not a whole org. You're just a group formed from several orgs making a task force.
Right.
And that's a very different thing. So if these guys are Second Inquisition... I mean, it's a different expectation.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Is all it is.
Yeah.
And Operation Antigen isn't necessarily remember the Second Inquisition is a groups of hunters.
Yes.
Is the V5 term of it. It's not necessarily one broad group.
It's an umbrella term to sort of represent the entire varying movements against vampires.
And that is also where I'm like, you know, because it's misleading. When you hear Inquisition, mm-hmm. what do you think of?
You think church.
You think of the Inquisition.
Right.
Right? It's weird. When I hear Bob, I think of my name. I don't think of Bob the Builder. I think of me.
Right, right.
It's weird because it's, you know, what's the first source must be what it says is, right? And that's how it is. And in a second Inquisition could be frightening.
Yeah.
Right? With what they knew the first time, imagine the second run and a nice, you know, discussion with someone. You could do your own thing. But this one was like lighthearted. We had to make a salient version of what could possibly, don't want to ruffle feather org that could. Okay.
So I would just like to state my personal issue with this, and you can refute it if you like. Maybe you have a different perspective. My big issue is, again, I've never lived in England. I don't know exactly how their government operates. I don't know what rights the people there have, but I assume it being a democratic country, there's probably some sort of rights pertaining to how people are treated. What I'm presented with here is essentially an umbrella of mortal observation where they can tap into everything. They have access to everything, cameras, recording devices. They can track phones even if they're off. Okay, does that technology exist? Sure. But all that being said, they're able to track down and murder vampires because essentially they look different in IR. They look different on a temperature camera. And to me, that's where my ability to like cope with that logic really disconnects. Where I'm like, how is that possible? How can I wrap my brain around this where it's so pervasive? It's so wrapped into everything. It is more powerful and more pervasive than the menace of vampires that it's trying to destroy. And I just can't comprehend how that's possible. Part of my brain goes, it's just a game, shut up and play it. But another part of me is like, yeah, but it needs to have some degree of realism. And for me, this breaks it.
That's a statement.
I like the idea of the Second Inquisition. I think it's cool. I think it could be very cool to have that sort of secret organization hunting your every move and needing to really play to the strengths of the Masquerade. But when it's just, you know, I got into a fight in the street and the threat level raises and now it's just impossible to do anything. Like, to me, that's too video gamey and I just don't dig it.
There's something to that. The other effect, I think, that worked here, and it's kind of psychological to me and just me being, you know, weird. I'm going through the book and I'm reading how it says this organization's formed, mm-hmm. but it shows some strong photos of a protest,
mm-hmm.
right? It shows the good old Met of the police force of good old England on one side trying to keep the peace, stop these people who came out to, well, protest, right. or maybe out and out riot. And they got some cool photo here, right?
Mm-hmm.
They got a guy, I mean, every walk of life here you can see, they got someone who's definitely punk.
Right.
And feeling it right front there. However, the guy who's the rabble-rouser is the dude with his hands in his pockets looking Joe Cool, right?
Right.
Has the suit jacket there, the shirt open, just kind of leaning back, verbally laying into the people in front of him. And everyone's just waiting for something to pop off, a very tense situation.
Right.
And that's what I think the point was in mentioning Antigen, Operation Antigen. And it's that's the goal. If you look past the words, it's... In other words, we're trying to hit all sorts of levels here, Nate.
Mm-hmm.
What I got here is that we need to establish that there is a second Inquisition presence because we need to back up that it was stated when the first book launched, Queen Anne gets killed by X, Y, and Z.
Sure.
So we need to have something to relate to why they're there. We need to have Mithras because who above anyone would have a reason for... How would these mortals know
sure.
where to go and who to hit if they didn't have someone drop the info? So that's where Mithras is with Monty Coven. Okay, we got that. Well, now how do we create that? And I got to think the authors went, shit! I have no idea. Look at this guy.
Right.
Look at this Mithras. The stats are crazy. The stuff he could do. Everyone, like, he's just going to go, he's going to get what he wants. Well, look at everybody else's stats and combined. I mean,
right.
They're in place, have been there longer. And you have this debate. In other words, it's a story. And like all stories, something has to fall.
Right.
And here is your reason. They tell you the detail verbally. This is how the hunters can work for you if you can't see how it works. But trust me, they're also saying... Or however you tell it, feel free to tell it your way.
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is one way.
Absolutely.
Operation Antigen does it. And the other flip of it is look at the photos. It's entirely possible in your game that the people do and are writing against these weird what have you, or are talking about or angry about or whatever, but the police officials are looking for this terrorist group.
Right.
Called Antigen, that are coming in. In other words, they're never going to catch them. They don't want to catch them.
Right.
And that's, you know, and that's the point. And so that's really why they're able to go around and do it with impunity. But I did, like you, wanted to see where this group comes out to jump a vampire, and it's some hot-looking torter number like Victoria Ashes Chilled, who's at a nightclub, like the Electric, I believe it's called, hanging out there, doing her thing, talking to folks. And they're like, oh, blank body, boom, let's get her. Or IC0, as they call them, as in I.
Yeah, yeah. IC0. It's pretty cool.
I thought that was very cute.
It's very, and, very cool.
And a jumper, there should be a room that jumped them, right? Because that's what they do. One of the coolest stories I heard on the news was when I visited England, was about some guy got jumped in the street by some random other guys. And the crowd responded. The police got there to get the crowd off of trashing these guys.
Right.
You know why? One of them had a machete.
Right.
And that just didn't suit right. And one of the people that stopped it, they've had women get in the face of people who were going to machete a soldier, right? Like terrorist extremists that were there, and they just stood in their way. I mean, this is a people very proud of their street and very, very apt to defend it. Foreign, domestic, doesn't matter. They got pride, and they also got security from doing that, right?
Right.
And very much it's hard to put that in a book and get you to understand that. If you didn't look into it. And they're not trying to. They're just trying to leave it.
Yeah, I was going to say also, you know, they give you all of the information you need to really effectively run this. And that's the point here. It's not necessarily what I feel, what it means to me. It's that there is information in here for running that effectively based on the story they're trying to tell. And in that regard, it does it.
Not to take away from your point, and trust me, I'm not. There's just different ways you could have done information to make it stick better.
Mm-hmm.
But for the layman, this is good enough, right? As we've said. Now, the Operation Antigen personnel are pretty typical. You have one guy who is really good at his job, stands out. He's a cowboy, a real go-getter, believes in what he's got to do and believes in his cause. And one day his wife is taken and they're like, man, make her a vampire, and daughter gets killed. And whatever reason, he comes out with true faith.
Yes. Yes, he does.
And he's here to lead the cause, right?
Yes, he does.
Enter your surveillance ops expert, Anna Kirwari, which strangely is very close, in my opinion, to stating that the multitasking ability of women is a superpower by gender. Her sole power is her ability to multitask. Look, she multitasks well, and she's good at technical know-how and maybe some tactics, because she is the one that was able to tell people to capture an IC0 that she could see on camera, but nobody could see past the wall it was hiding behind. But she guessed it was there tactically, and she told everyone to shoot there. And they shot through the wall, and they took it down. Superpower.
Yeah, it's a pretty stock standard stereotypical hunter team. I feel like you may have just waxed over the fact that the main character, I believe his name is Ishak Khan, was driven into true faith. Because his children were kidnapped and then embraced by some unnamed vampiric forces, and that drove him into true faith. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. So it's a team.
Have you not been driven into true faith?
No, I've never had the opportunity to get driven into true faith.
Just last week, my neighbor had his wife taken and his daughter shot in front of him, and he immediately turned to God and inherited superpowers.
Sweet. That's
pretty. He defends her neighborhood now with smiles.
That's awesome.
And hugs.
That's awesome. Unwavering in his loyalty to the crown and faith in God. So that's cool.
But do you? It's an example of why he has it, and it's there.
Yeah.
Strike team leader Paul Richards is another great guy who, pound for pound, is one of the most powerful put in print for V5 for what he can do. It's on par with some elders, in fact, that they made for this game. And I think it's very interesting. It's Operation Firebrand, but you got to remember the story behind the stats. It represents a guy who's battle-hardened, very good at what he does.
Yes.
He's born to hurt, and he hurts those who are born. And it's that simple. Not a maniac, but let's just say calculating leads a team and will do what he has to do, and has successfully killed an IC0 before. Now, has a weird thing against Muslims.
Yeah, yeah. He's a bigot. Right.
Prejudice against him. Get ready for that. And I need to address it. Just because they put a character in here that's racist that doesn't mean the company who wrote the story is racist or the company that printed it. It's literally a take for a character in here to explain extreme trauma at war from where he was and comes back with some of that prejudice.
Well, they do a really thorough job of, I think, establishing that players and storytellers have an obligation to address these things sensitively and to be cautious of how your players respond and be an adult about it. So I really commend them for that.
I'm handling this in a media sense. In other words, you guys heard it here, might settle for only this and not ever pick up the book and not read that they did that and then run off half-cocked on a Facebook post.
Right.
And say, this book's incredibly racist and make a stance on something you heard from us. If you heard it from us, do diligence and do your homework.
Yeah.
Keep our name out your mouth unless you're going to read the material is what I'm saying.
Bob got all intense about that one.
Just being true, man. You're going to quote me? Make sure you understand me.
I agree with you.
I think those companies should say it, but guess what? We don't earn a paycheck for them. We earn it from you, and you know who we are. And we're making sure you get that from us. Much love, but hold the war until you understand the context, all I'm saying.
Yeah.
And going on from there, some pretty standard. Now, what we have here, you may think these guys are lackluster, you would do better, or what have you, but they're not the focus of the story.
No.
Right? They gave you stuff. This is all about you from purchase. Getting a stack of characters, no effort to make them.
Right.
Getting a stack of NPCs, no effort for you to make them. All you need to do is read and then tell your tale and make your adjustments where you were.
Right.
We're just kind of going through it, funning a little bit. It went in some different directions, and sometimes we feel strongly about it. Doesn't make it a bad book, just we're weird and we're telling you our opinion. And that's all we're doing.
Right.
But to roll past these guys, specialist antigen equipment. What'd you think about that?
Oh, man. I have lots of opinions about those. I'll just talk about one. Off the top of my head, one that, let's see, one that I thought that was a little funky was the spray that they use to embalm the dead vampires rapidly so that they don't decay. And I was like, what? That's an interesting and new idea. I had not thought that that would be a thing.
It's a thing. I can't do that. It's the only way I could do it. Folks, I find it laughable. I sincerely do. There's no way, right? This is too many science books. If you know the curse, you know where it came from, everything else, it's ridiculous you would create something that would, like, it's a chemical that stops it from, how would it stop it?
Well, yeah, one of the other things that they talk about in here are UV lamps, which I'll spoil this for you if you're not familiar with the vampire. UV rays do nothing to a vampire. And in here, they don't necessarily say that they damage vampires, but they say they're a distraction at best. I'll save you the effort. They're a distraction the same way a flashlight's a distraction. It does nothing to a vampire. Like, UV lamps are utterly ineffective. We've already established. Vampires, Cain was cursed. Angels, God, holy, magic, that's why. Not because the sun has UV rays.
I'm going to hurt you worse. All of these come from Blade.
Dude.
Oh, you're laughing.
No, I was trying to avoid making the connection because they even have the scientifically developed anticoagulant. And I was like, come on. Why do you have the Blade serum?
So, that's all I, it's all my brain is going. I don't need to say anything more than that, I think. Interesting. I hope that you guys get more creative. We talked in Teach Me How recently about how to make a game campy. That's how. The moment you bring out embalming sprays and UV lamps and they're effective, you're playing Blade.
Yeah.
That's what you're playing. Welcome to camp at that point. Just no way around it. And that's it. We'll move on. They have something in here I did think was cool for the stories told. Threat levels. I like threat levels in any game. I enjoy them because as a storyteller, it's a tool that I myself have used for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, years now. That if players do X and this goes unchecked and nothing's done, like influence-wise or anything, to cover it up or what have you, then what happens is hunters get more informed. There should be a reaction is what I should say. There should be something that comes from the world. Nate put it best. When you do something, the world should respond.
Right.
And that's the point, because your characters are the sole focus. If a player is just able to go into a gas station, fang out, rip out the protective glass, rip most of the head off the neck, feed like it's a big gulp at the, they fill up with their 40 ounce and leave,
right,
smile to the camera, and nothing occurs, that player's going to play for another week, maybe two.
Right. What are you trying to establish at that point? You know, you're basically playing Grand Theft Auto. And while that's great fun, that's not this game. I really do appreciate that they do in every chapter have the threat levels and how it can impact the scene. They give you, the storyteller, advice on how to impact and maneuver your scene in response to what the current threat level is at. Lots of games are using something similar now. Like in Shadowrun, there's like a heat meter that the hotter it is, the harder it is for you to function.
So, and what we have here then are the necessarily the stories. And I think we could kill forever and a day going over the specific stories. Do you want to go over highlights that you noted, or do you want to just...
I'll start with the first chapter. Basically, the first chapter, and, you know, jump in wherever you feel like it, but basically the first chapter is the awakening of the characters. They are brought to a museum after there's some construction that happens, uncovering their sarcophagi. There's a Malkavian, gets wind of this, has the sarcophagi moved to a different location, an offsite museum warehouse, at which point he is instructed through the cult, through various means, basically from Roger to Camden, to wake up these five and give them a letter, give them information, which is what happens. This first chapter basically functions as the learn your characters, get your feet wet, figure out how to function in the world sort of scenario. They're given a letter and told the five of them are being given the task of tracking down four of the Mithraic artifacts to, I don't know if they go into specifics of why, but it really doesn't matter. Basically, your characters have been awoken. They were put into this torpor. The loyalty to Mithras is instilled deep within them, and they're trying to come to terms with who they are. There's an opportunity to feed in this chapter. They meet the Malkavian, they meet a Gangrel, they get kind of updated with the current situation, and then they get attacked by Operation Antigen, at which point they have to flee.
It's as simple as that. It's all I can...
It's pretty right? much just a straight summary.
and that's it. I mean, all of them are kind of, they're written just like that, right? This is what happens, this is what occurs. And what's interesting about this is their terminology even. It's like what the storyteller goals are. Right, which is interesting. Before, it wasn't really there. It was like, in this story, we want the summary and blah, blah, blah. No, storyteller goals, which you're meant to do in each chapter to hit home, to keep everything on course and what have you. And that's it, right?
Right.
One thing I want to highlight, in each story, as you read them, or at least as I got from it, does give you insight into some how they view some of these NPCs.
Right.
Would be feeling. In regards to what's going on. And one point that I had thought of, and I never really put more than that, was just a thought, because I've ran few London games, but even when I did, I just didn't think Queen Anne was that vulnerable. And that's, they kind of write her that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And not only that, Rampant Diabrus was an interesting twist to the character, good old Queen Anne. I don't know. I had always thought that if you were capable of being a predator enough to even Diabrize, then you probably have your convictions intact. Right, you got to have your reason you're doing it beyond just, hey, it was kinky fun.
Right.
And that's just me. But they do highlight a haunting effect. And that is, if you've served under a god for X amount of time, any amount of time really, and that god is gone and presumed dead, and you know they're gone, and you swear to yourself they are dead, then you are left in such a vacuum that for you not to step forward and step up is ridiculous. But if you step up before... There's no way you have the power of that god, or you would have been a rival of him.
Right.
Right? So when they're dead, you're trying to fill those shoes and make sure everyone still knows their place. Keep them underneath your feet. How do you do that? And Queen Anne manages to do it, but that's because of her sire Valerius, laying the groundwork to prop her up and forward to sit where she is. And Valerius was named, I believe it was regent, right. To rule in Mithras' absence before. So most of the denizens of London had no idea. You know, Mithras is not unusual for him to be gone or torpid, as they say, or gone abroad. He did that quite a bit. And in his absence, there would always be a regent. You know, you had your de Camden, or now you had Valerius.
Yeah, right.
And Queen Anne, though, after a time of Mithras' recent departure, it was assumed he's dead. And why they assume it is because they tried to kill him.
Right. Well, and another important key element to that is when Valerius was regent and Mithras was in torpor for a very long time, missing, no one knew where he was, Valerius sort of opened up the doors for the Camarilla and allowed their influence, as it's presented, to sort of roll into London. And when Mithras woke up, he was super pissed and freaked out and basically told Decamden, told Valerius rather, you're no longer the regent while I'm away, and now your chilled Queen Anne is, so screw yourself. And that's kind of how that rolled out and led to Valerius conspiring to kill Mithras. So
now, I know what you're thinking. You guys reviewed a book where weren't Mithras and Queen Anne lovers? It's weird. What happened there? Yes, you're correct. You're correct, they were. And her first diablerie was because Mithras condoned it. He wanted her hooked. And that's what he did. But he did it because he did fall in love with her briefly. And was infatuated, I guess is a better term. She fell in love with him. And did that. And then, like, Valerius is in the corner doing whatever. And he had his own nefarious reasons for doing so. But that's just... we don't talk about that.
There's all kinds of interesting contradictory elements.
You have to do it that way. But it's one of those things where it's like... because it could not just have been Queen Anne is your child and now she's in charge. Who does that?
Right.
You don't go, you sucked, so I'll take your lesser and make them in your position. That person will do a better job. No, that's called a moron. Right? Wait a second. So the dad sucks. So you're going to take the son who's been learning from the dad? Are you out of your mind? You're going to get a less result. He doesn't even have the experiences dad did. And it's the same principle that I'm coming from. And no, the tie-in there that you need to catch is that Queen Anne and Mithras had history. And the history is he could control her. And that was the point, and many means of control, whether it was love, devotion, fear, all three she had for him. And that's where it is. But it doesn't stop someone from conspiring against him to have him killed. And this book outlines a very interesting truth to a certain bombing and leading Mithras somewhere to get exploded and completely wiped out. And everyone assumes they're dead from that to enable them to move on, which I thought was interesting in a way they took to explain why everyone would now move when Mithras has been gone before for a long time and has come back. Why would you take that risk?
Right. Well, and it presents a somewhat contradictory account of that whole bombing, the 1941 thing, and Mithras awakening and being diablerized. The timeline that was presented earlier, and again, referenced the beginning of this podcast, where we were like, maybe don't pay attention to that stuff, is contradicted here. And trust me, I went through 5 different books yesterday trying to find out if I was wrong or not, because, you know, let's face it, my memory can be for shit. But no, it's a different timeline. They adjust it. They change it. It is what it is. Welcome to the new game. So moving on, this next chapter, that all plays an important part of the acquisition of the next ritual item. So, cool thing, your characters, having been asleep for 70 years, they now get to go and attend Elysium at the new Ventru stronghold. I'm reminded immediately of that Vitesse card, the Ventru headquarters, which is the Shard, this massive, beautiful building in the middle of downtown London. That is a Ventru stronghold. They've worked together to have this shrine to their own greatness built. And this is where you get to go and attend Elysium. Go ahead, Bob, if you're going to say something.
Nope.
Now, they get to interact with a variety of different characters, primarily of which is Queen Anne. They get to play a role in determining the outcome of a kindred rivalry. They get to meet an interesting Banu Hakim and help them feed and kind of learn about the current situation in the streets of London and how the Operation Antigen, the Second Inquisition, if you will, is affecting the kindred of the city. We get introduced to a number of different characters, and we just get to participate. Finally, we get to have a conversation with Queen Anne. They will work to retrieve the item, and Queen Anne gives them the opportunity to do a favor for her. And that favor is hunt down and kill her sire, which is cool. It's interesting. It's definitely a unique scenario. So there's tons of things that your players can do in this chapter to retrieve their item. Would you like to add more?
Oh, me?
Yes.
I'm good. The thing is that there's a lot in there, and just the filler there, just to participate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. So moving on.
There is a lot of stuff in here. There are some inconsistencies with how I feel certain characters are portrayed. I will say that. However, I think that, you know, there's a lot of fun things that your players can be involved in. It's a pretty complex situation. And we move on to the next chapter.
I just wanted to mention one thing
mm-hmm.
of interest that I was waiting for politer words to come to my head. There's a part in here where Queen Anne asks the players to go kill Valerius. There's a lot that I had taken issue with, right? One, that statement makes completely no sense to me. There isn't anything necessarily that Valerius had done
mm-hmm.
to Queen Anne directly. In fact, he's been supporting her, right?
Right.
Bringing her up, helping her out, even gave her the reins, gave her London as like a gift. So, right. You know, there you go. And she took it. It's what she wanted, and he gave it to her. And then her response is to have him killed. Okay. You want to call a paranoid elder? Weird. That's what I'm going to say.
My conclusion, I'll let you finish, of course, but my conclusion was just that she wanted to, she was of the belief Mithras was back, and she wanted to prove to Mithras that she was on his side.
Yeah, I don't know, because she planned the whole book to have, to do away with Mithras as well.
Yeah.
She knows that she's fucked.
Right.
When he comes back, she's dead too. Why eliminate the one person who could back you, who also doesn't like Mithras? So it didn't make sense to me. But I get that. Might have been a thought at the moment. Who knows? Princes be princes, right? They yep. be princing. So, but then it's like, great. Here you, the player characters, why don't you go ahead and kill my sire? All right. So the player's going to do it. And then you, the ST, look at, well, you do what any logical storyteller goes, well, just how strong is Valerius? Well, damn. Okay. Yeah, there that is. Oh, well, let's just look to the back of the book at the pre-gen characters that they were... Oh.
Right.
Oh. Right. Well, they got like an army with them, right? Queen Anne gives them guns.
She does, in fact, give them guns.
Right? That's what she could do. That's cool. Yeah. Doesn't he have retained... Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But you're not going to find them on a sheet. Conveniently, they leave off whatever he would have had to assist him.
Right.
So they just have him dangling there. Please kill him. Kill Valerius.
Right. But okay. But also we learned that his retainers have somehow been taken from him. They're no longer loyal to him.
They're no longer Valerius's retainers. And they will turn and aid in the job.
Those points are all really good points. And I definitely agree with you on that. However, that is not the first thing that went through my mind. The first thing that went through my mind was Queen Anne, paranoid, wants to have her sire killed. Maybe as an act to protect her domain. Maybe she thinks her sire had a change of heart. Maybe she wants to convince Mithras that she is loyal to him, which is obviously untrue. So she meets these five vampires that have been missing for 70 years, doesn't know anything about them, vaguely remembers them from back in the day. And her first request, her first task for them is go kill my sire. And I was like, how does that make sense? Like, what? But
because what's going to happen is I know players. They're all going to go and they're all going to look at Valerius and go, hey, you know, Queen Anne sent us here to kill you. And he's going to go, pardon me? Like, what ST is going to be like, the jig is up. Have at thee. No, they're going to be like, well, you want to talk. All right, that's interesting. Let's have a chat. And they wrote that possibility in. Now you talk to him, and it turns out now that he knows about it, he's just going to, leave.
Right, I'll be gone. Goodbye.
Time to leave, then. Check, please. And he's out the door, you know?
Yep.
He doesn't own a pair of fighting trousers, is what I'm saying. He is a master at melee of five. And he has a brawl of four. Bruce Lee and him were rivals. But those days are long gone.
Did you check?
Just not in him anymore.
Did you check what Mithras's melee was? I don't know.
Oh, I did. And we'll leave it at that.
Okay. Okay. Right? Remember, we got to take our own medicine here.
Correct.
No,
correct.
No, yeah, suck on that cough drop.
Cognitive dissonance. Okay, so
gargle
we get to
with the salt.
Correct. We move on, and we get to
the Tremere chapter.
Yeah, it's pretty much that. It's it's the Tremere chapter. Find Shri Sansa, all that fun stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And have a chat. And you're going to find a similarity through all of them. And by now, what it is, I'm trying not to like, oh, here's everything in a small synopsis and quirky, poking humor. Relevance is what we're getting to. These are all relevant, and even establish an order to them. They were written that way, right? What I want you to take from each of these chapters, though, in sincerity, the recovering effect here, that I made this viable for me, is that when you look at the reactions that they write in for how one might respond, it builds a framework if you're a storyteller who couldn't think of what would happen.
Right.
See what I'm saying? You don't have to mimic what they did, but now seeing an outline of thought from soup to nuts, or nuts to soup, as they say, you can make your own soup. Right? And understanding how that might roll out. And you will have to. I promise you, players are going to wreck this whole thing. they're not going to do it the way the book says they will, and you will have to do more storytelling work to sell this more than anything else to get that going. And that's just a given. I'm assuming that's with any of the choose your own adventure books, that you have to spice them up a bit, because guess what? Players buy things. If someone knows what they're about to get into, well, shame on them. Or I guess you get to have an acting lesson.
It's pretty much the same with any chronicle. Your players are going to defy expectation. And granted, they do a great job of trying to give you, I would say, every angle. In most of these chapters, they're presenting you with pretty much every angle. Now, it's up to you to read through this and go, okay, how do I do that? Anyways, this chapter is basically like a micro cat and mouse during a scavenger hunt. Because you're trying to find Sri Sansa, you're trying to, you know, track him down to get this item. Eventually you do, you communicate with him, and they make it a point to show that interaction with humanity. This character, also, I forgot, in the previous chapter and in this chapter, we get flashbacks. We get big, important flashbacks with info. In this one, we travel back in time to 1888, and in the Victorian era, we get to experience the embrace and ensuing existence of Sri Sansa and how he developed. Do you have any thoughts about the way that these flashbacks are used?
I think they're good. I think the flashback technique works wonders into a chronicle for telling a story that the storyteller knows nobody will ever learn about your poor NPC.
Right.
Right?
I do think it's clever.
I also want to add that they don't work. I've done them. They don't work. They just don't. People would much rather you sit down and explain to them why an NPC did something and learn about them that way than they ever would wanting to roleplay through a flashback about that person.
Well, the other thing about a flashback, and we've talked about this before, is that putting your players in a situation where their characters are able to go back in time and, quote, affect things, it really loses its potency when what they do actually doesn't affect anything. And that's true almost universally about all of these flashback scenes included in this book. They can go and they can participate and sort of, they're separated. Usually they take the place of one person, separated into five different perspectives to replicate the existence of their characters. And no matter what they do, essentially the outcome is the same because it's a flashback. It's history. But to me, that becomes ineffective when your players don't really have an effect. They become the audience to your storytelling.
What I honestly would state is that a flashback's best done by typing it up as a memory and handing it to the players and taking that moment to go, you know, have a wee, get a drink, let the players read, come back, sit down, and resume from there with them having an interesting memory that was there for them to have. But don't roleplay through it because of that very effect. If it's static, make it static. If it's something they would know because it's a great scene, write well, give them the small story, let them see the snippet, and then let them make decisions informed.
Yeah.
You know, translate it through the medium of what's more important, their character. And that's the thing. I think the focus is definitely not on the players. throughout most of this. It's about telling you about these people in London and the state and blah, 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 blah. Now, it warns you. It says, hey, you can slow this down. You can make it a big chronicle all you like, and every player's run everywhere else and enjoy stuff, and it's
right.
That's there too. So don't let that be a thing. Like, you can own this book and use it all or use none of it. But that's, and everything they say, and me and Nate both felt that that's a cop out. We'll review the book, and that's that's the idea. We don't give a safety net for that. Instead, what we're adding is that if I'm reading you correctly, you agree. Flashbacks the hot garbage. To use, because there's more effective means to get home who this person is and was. It just takes longer. And in this book, I think it's written so, cool, have a flashback, this is what happened, it justifies where we're going from here.
Right.
Or what they might have to do.
I think it's a very clever idea that is very difficult to execute properly and effectively. I think it's what I would call an advanced function. I'm very torn on it. You know, feel free. Work it to however you work it.
Why I'm negative on it is because there's a TV show that did a lot of this already. It's called Highlander. And I brought him up earlier. I've seen Blade here. I've seen Highlander twice.
If you want my honest opinion about this, Bob, I definitely can co-sign on your Highlander. But to me, this really calls to like the Anne Rice Interview with a Vampire. And that's great, but that's that. And I don't think that's what Vampire the Masquerade is.
I completely disagree with the Anne Rice link. I want to talk about that. What's where's that link?
I mean like Interview with a Vampire. So Interview with a Vampire, it takes place in the modern times where the vampire character is retelling these flashbacks and these times in history. That's what I mean by that. I've never read any Anne Rice. I don't know if her books are like that. But that movie.
So I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying, and it would be great. Can you run a game where the actions of the, like, you know, it starts off just like, imagine Interview with the Vampire. It starts off with him going in a room, and sits down. And he's telling his tale, right? Now imagine the players are playing what's in the memory. Can you run a game like that? And the answer is yes.
Right, because you're telling the game in real time.
Exactly, you're telling the game in real. They're in that era, running through that time.
Right,
we know where it's going to pick up in an epilogue format or what have you. So that's it. So we know at least one person lives, but we're all playing people that we don't know if they're around anymore.
Right,
that's a way to do it. That's brilliant, and that's there. I get it. Thank you for connecting that for me. What I was saying in the Highlander capacity, it's like they walk around as them, and then because it's the way they do it, like when links eyes with Queen Anne. In one chapter, then the memory starts,
that's how it goes.
And it's the same thing in Highlander, and I was like, "That's so weird how that's chosen."
It's done. I think in every chapter, and they meet the kindred for the first time, and suddenly they're whisked away into a flashback. It unfolds, and then they come back, and the vampire's like, "You done? You ready to talk?"
Are you done? You were staring at me a long time, creepy. Yeah, did you get a look?
The five of you are just sort of staring off into space for a while. Are you back?
Talk to me about the underground and the Nos.
Yeah, so chapter 4 brings us to the Nosferatu underworld, the London underground. The Nosferatu, Roger de Ward, the ruler of the underground labyrinth, holds the next item. From here, your characters journey into the London Underground and begin the intense search for Roger de Ward and the next item, a ritual dagger. All sorts of characters and interesting interactions occur. You meet a wall-crawling, one-humanity Nosferatu monster face. You encounter strangers who are lost. You encounter a ritual that slowly drains you of your blood, causing you to gain more hunger, which I thought was an interesting new thing.
Right.
Yeah, so it's meant to be like a kind of a suspenseful, like, horror. You know, like, you're meant to explore more the horror, the hunger, the unknown, the feeling of the walls closing in on you. And I just thought it was interesting that this was different than what I was used to with the Nosferatu.
And don't forget, in here it also points out, horror can evoke traumatic memories and trigger phobias, but this is not the purpose of the story and should never be utilized for any dramatic or immersive effect.
It's good. It's good that they got that out there to let you know.
Like, when I saw that, when I read that, I was like, we are about to get into some shit. Horror. Yes. Can trigger people. Tremet. Oh, man. We're going to summon Doug Deep. Let's get into this chapter. Let's do it. And it's there.
I do want to point out, having read this chapter, and I'll fully understand why the Second Inquisition has come down on London with such ferocity. And it's because deep within the London Underground, there is a Nosferatu who, in order to attract victims down into his tunnels, puts out ads in the local newspaper and on the internet asking people to come and join his club, and he uses his name to do it. And so people come down into the tunnels and they get lost. Then he kills them, feeds on them, whatever.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's there. I mean, that doesn't bother me. They can't all be aces, right? So there's that works. Why anybody hasn't stopped them? Probably because their mentality of the chapter, I think, is nailed home. It says there's a prince for the London above, and then there's the one below.
Yep.
And that's not something new either. That's a very Requiem. In fact, Requiem did it first. Did it best, in fact, with that mentality. They do have that dichotomy for one of their book campaigns, so I won't get into because we're not about that. Right now, but it's very much hallmark of that, which is why that was more digestible to me, to see what goes on. They have a picture for mass feeding, right? Really, it's just looks like a bunch of blood bags discarded on the floor, because apparently Nosferatu can't clean, and that's always baffled me. I just want to add that, just because you look horrible, does that mean you're suddenly the most slothful thing ever?
Right, like, right.
If you fed on blood, wouldn't you put it in a trash bag?
Wouldn't you clean up your goddamn room, you pig?
And they don't, but it's cool for the artwork. I mean, yeah, bloody.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
the artwork is cool.
It's good for that. But, you know, horror, is it there? Yes. Maybe I'm a little jaded. Admittedly, I've seen a lot of horror and whatever, but I enjoy being scared. I enjoy reading something and feeling like the victim going through it, or the soon-be victim or survivor, and kind of going through that fact. And when I realized it's like, it's not too horrific, it dawned on me, oh, it's in case there are people who can't handle blood in a vampire game. That's great, right? It's all there, and some interesting characters and whatnot were decently written.
Yeah.
Good things to run underway. Definitely showcases the London Underground. I like the photos that kind of keep you riveted. And I would almost argue that I would even take screenshots, maybe make a PowerPoint as you present this to your crew if they're going through it, because that's how much I like the shots in here, to hammer home the scenes they're in.
Yeah. Does a great job of establishing that. You know, feeling through visual representation, through the visual medium. I think that a lot of the photographs in here are very good. I will say that. I've heard a lot of people complain about the art direction of V5. Save the drama for your mama. I think that the art direction is not bad. Is every piece of artwork in here a freaking Rembrandt and a Picasso? No. But what do you want? It's game book.
Right. It's... You said it best, my man. That is exactly exact feeling. And then you basically go through here, and you got to do stuff for DeWord to basically play that game to get the item from him, and that's of course the goal, right? As Nate said, this is a giant scavenger hunt for what's going on of a plot, which can be a lot of fun. Now, that said, I want to take a note because I feel that, you know, we kind of get where this is going, right? The big dances, we're getting to it. The finales really, I think, is the more relevant point to talk about. The aspect of this book building up to this point is really just chock-filled with opportunities, right? I would treat every scene in here, every story in here, as a scene. Meaning it gets set up, let the players do what they do. All you got to do as an ST is react as the world to what they do.
Right.
And move forward. And you do that, this is a very rewarding book. It will offset a lot of your work and telling about what happens in your London. I would set it up, called The Fall of London, great. Really, it's a primer. It's trying to continue a story that they did launch that to bridge that gap, but the benefit of us telling you that, remember, focus on V5, not what happened before. Not that it didn't happen before, but you shouldn't try to bridge the gap.
Yeah, I don't think that it's important. I think as a storyteller and player, your goal should not be to reconcile the information that's presented in here with what's already come before, because you're going to not be able, you're going to find yourself incapable of enjoying this material as it's presented. And quite frankly, I feel like it can be a fun and entertaining scenario to run your players through. That being said,
In full honesty, this is some insight that we'll give you. Me and Nate both read this in a very negative outlook. And I read it again. And I looked at it again. And I remembered my own philosophy. There's two ways to look at something. You can look at it to the bad, and you'll be there in 10, 15 minutes, give it a cursory look, and chuck it to the side because it wasn't perfect. However, if you go through and read what they're trying to do, and look at the broader picture, and then realize the benefits to you that's put in front of you, you begin to look at this as a toolbox. Right? Which is all this is. My expectation with this would be a story source book. Right? When we heard it was going to be actually a Fall of Ninja was going to be a story, I was disappointed. So I went into this with already a bias. I was ready to be disappointed, and I was not disappointed in that. However, that's the perception. If you stand back, rinse the head a bit, step forward and look at it as, okay, it's V5. We have all the players. We have the Mithras and Camden. There were the three main focuses for me, Valerius has mentioned. Player involvement. I don't have to use the crap characters in the back. I'd rather my players make, you know, five people make their own and throw in. Or typically for me, it's a game of 10 and five of them are really important and in a cult. And the rest of them aren't. And get to see how that works out. And that could be dynamic, explosive fun. In other words, it's more important how you use the material they present than you to run it as presented. Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me.
Find your fun. Whenever you look at one of these, it's find your fun. Find what works, discard the rest.
Yeah.
And that's probably a shorter method to do it. But just letting you know that is because when you get to the finale of this book, right, to where things catch up and it gets to the end, a lot of fans get mad when there isn't a tie-off, right? When they don't say flat out who won, who right. lost, who
what
died,
is,
who
what lived. Is the end result here? You know, what's the truth?
You're not going to get that here, right? Because folks still aren't getting it. It's your London,
right?
They wrote this to say it's your London. You say what happened. You just ran these scenarios. You should know how this is going to go, right? And then that's your tale for your London. The Fall of London is all our Londons when all of us run the game and get to our own result. And that's what they're saying. They don't want the exact result they write out. They want the result that you enjoyed. And that's the point. So that's really all I have to taper off the end. Because I'm certain there are things Nate wants to say. And the final part is that there is a character in here that I do adore. And I adore very much. Victoria Ashes Chilled is in here. And when I read her, first when I see the photo of her, that's an amazing shot. It's one of my favorite photos for Vampire. I think they've used with people. I'm not a fan of putting real people. Because I've said this, it breaks my immersion.
Right.
It breaks my ability to look at it as whatever. But this is perfect. This woman is more than catty. She's disappointed, but she's serious and powerful, but sexy and disturbed, but elegant. And this is all wrapped in a single photo. The guy behind her doesn't even look like a douchebag. Right? Typically, that's my current go-to. I'm very derogatory towards all the weird, has to fit a certain style. Like, there couldn't be a... Like, I would adore there being a guy with a beer gut and a leather jacket right. just standing nearby. Like, I'd serve her. Yeah, right. She's cool.
I'm over here like that talking to my mic.
Right? Like, that would be normal to me. But no, this guy's behind her, and it's a very real guy. But the way he is he looks haunted. He looks like someone that is definitely dedicated to who's in that throne. That chair shot they have of her... he's got tattoos and whatnot, and that's sort of a trend, piercings and the lifestyle he might be in and they're involved in. But then you read about him and you read how she sees things and where she's at. She's an abandoned child. She doesn't know why her sire made her and boom, gone. Why? Because she never wanted to be a vampire, right? That's the thing. Her sire just forced it upon her because she learned too much, which means you get an idea into Victoria Ash. She's kind of a bomb. Right? The way she's written, she comes in, and everyone adores what she does, Victoria Ash, that is, and as she's going about, she picks this woman to just sort of be a cat's paw, or go entertain people, and, you know, you seem very cool, for right now, my eye's on you, go have fun, and then she learns too much, and then she knows when she leaves, she has to kill her, or what she did, embrace her, and basically told her, well, the alternative's far worse, I love you, ta-ta, kisses, and bails.
Mm-hmm.
Is just gone. And then you get to read this character. Now, they don't do this. Beforehand, it would be something stupid. Like, she becomes hell-bent on practicing with stake and axe. and goes to town learning how to hunt down the woman who embraced her and ruined her. Nah, she reacts very realistically. I'm left here with huge shoes to fill. I got this wealth my sire left me with that I have to tend to. I gotta keep face because I'm a Torador. I gotta go to all these events, but man, I am not trying to be an enemy to anyone. I'm doing my own thing surviving here, and I fucking really hate the fact that I'm a vampire. I deal with you people. And she's very good at when someone comes to her and goes, hey, how about I owe you a boon? You do, nah, I'm good. I'm good. What'd you need, though? I kind of was looking for a haven, thought I heard you were good. Eh, no problem. Where do you need it? Like over there, but you know, I'll owe you later, but can we talk? Nope, you don't owe me at all. Have it. Really? Yep, go over there. Get away from me. Yeah, thanks. Toodles, kisses, and walks off. Why? She doesn't want to get wrapped up in that nonsense.
Right.
Because if she looks like a threat, Queen Anne going to come down on her.
Mm-hmm.
However, because she does this behavior, she's actually very, very popular with the denizens of the city. And accordingly, she's a threat to Queen Anne.
Right.
It's realistic. That's right. Every book and novel you ever wanted to read about. That's every princedom and a LARP you've ever been to. That's anyone anywhere who's getting into the idea of power and play.
Right.
And this is a realistic character.
And I think that those aspects are very important to this book. And it brings me to the conclusion of my feelings about this book. And I'm going to try to be as magnanimous as possible because I understand sort of our role as podcasters, our role as reviewers. And I'm going to tell you with utmost honesty, I am completely torn about this book. There are many things about this book that I appreciate, that I like, that I think are riveting, potentially compelling, some really good moments of storytelling. On the other hand, I want to emphasize this to you. This is my opinion. I think that this is a deeply flawed book in a lot of ways. I didn't bring it up earlier, and I typically don't ever bring it up, but I gotta be honest with you. If you are someone who is a bit pedantic, if you are someone who likes to pay attention to details beyond just the superficial writing, you're going to have problems with this. And what I mean by that is there's lots of editing errors. There's lots of proofreading issues. That's something that's very clear to me. And if you're someone who looks for that stuff, you're going to find it. You're going to find it a lot and more than you might be used to. So just be aware of that. Two, there are a lot of those issues that we talked about earlier, the cognitive dissonance. There's a lot of it in this book. And to me, I can tell that there were many different writers working on this book. And I feel, based on what I've read, that there was a push to get this book done quickly and to get it out fast, to hit a deadline. I don't know that to be a fact. This is just what I'm feeling based on what I've read. So I do, it is a 50-50. On one hand, I own the book. You know, I got the tabletop copy, the hardcover, and it's very beautiful. And I think it's all in all put together very well. It's got a lot of cool imagery, lots of cool maps. They think of pretty much everything for you, but I didn't come away feeling like it was less than an imperfect book that I think more time could have been spent on. And I think a better job could have been done. What I say, don't buy it. Look, like we said at the beginning, if you're playing this game with new players, if you're trying to get people into V5, this is a great book for you as a storyteller to help guide you into a new game. Would I buy it again? I don't know. I'd have to think long and hard on that. And personally,
some fun stuff.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, and personally, I'm not convinced that I would repurchase this book if given the opportunity.
So I know I would not, but that's because you knew I would not.
Right.
It's not a story source book. It's just stories.
It was damned from the beginning because it's a chronicle.
Right. And that's with me. That's with Bob with anything. I will buy material source books that I could use and reuse and are tools for me to use and get a lot from. And I won't buy because often your story is written by authors to tell you how to play a game. Don't need you. Don't want you. Don't need you.
Right.
You know, move on. You want to be a player in my game. And we'll talk. Then we'll gauge who's a good writer and who's whatever and all that stuff. And I never want to get into that because writing, anybody can write a story for someone and that person can like it. Will everybody like it? That's the test.
Right.
And that's what this is. And I never, ever want to question anybody's ability to step forward with that courage and to do that and do it well. You did it. That's great. However, when it's somebody telling me, and that's what it is, I have issues with that authority, right? Someone's going to sit there and tell me, in this scene, players will, and they will, and they will. I secretly sit back and go, I hope my players tear apart your weak NPCs. Right. Right? That's what's in my head. I hope they rain in hell this night, right now. And that's me. Because at the end of the night, I've never seen a player... Players have difficulty feeding.
Yeah.
Right? They do. They have to be vampires. It's hard to transition. Players have difficulty standing in front of a court of people who are... Some are elders, some aren't. And everyone's supposed to be better than them in their own mind. And when they're presented the correct way and that feeling is given, that person out of game can feel alienated. They can feel very weird and off-put and don't know what to do. And suddenly it's not fun anymore. And that's that could be traumatic. However, you do it because you tell them, hey man, let's pause. You look uncomfortable or sound uncomfortable. Look, total douchebag you're in front of. You got a character sheet. Let me help you through this. There's some things your character knows, and no way does this impact you. We're real, and we're just in a different world. And that needs to be said and accounted for. And I feel sometimes these scenarios are being ran by people brand new to game, and this is where you lose a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, because you hear that story. I ran that Giovanni's Chronicle, and man, my group quit after the first game session. And, you know, what did I do wrong? I did everything they said. I rolled it out accordingly and, you know, did it. And, you know, they got into a fight with a guy they shouldn't have, and one of them died, and he got mad, and blah, blah. And it's like, great. That's difficult. You know, here's some stuff we could tell you to kind of put a little band-aid on it, but that's all my point is that they lack in that, and that adds to why I don't like. But funny things in here that I refuse to end this without saying, because I have friends, all of you. I think it's funny the lack of attention and understanding of the Sabbatas in this book.
Oh, the utter failure to address them in a functional, realistic, more than one-dimensional way is hilarious in ways I can't even begin to describe.
So, my little grubby fingers together, let's look at Monty's pack. Monty Coven commands the loyalty of five kindred who are with him in the Mithraeum. They each have the statistics of an anarch revolutionary, because we didn't make the Sabbat in V5. All of them were initially loyal to Monty rather than Mithras. Wait a second. Time the fuck out. What do you mean they were all loyal? Hang on. He did the Verniculum with them.
Right.
That's a Valdery.
Right.
Yeah, what do you mean? There's like, he transcends that? He can't be... The Valdery was invented to force a bond on each and every member in the pact. The Valdery was invented to break that same nonsense. There's loyal... Nah. What are you even doing?
Right.
They're not five random people. There should be a priest in this pack. He's, sure, your duct is fantastic. You had to do a ritual. And that was before you were Mithras reborn.
I don't understand why you're opening the can of worms here about Valdaries and rituals and... Come on. That stuff doesn't exist.
If you're going to put Sabbat, each was originally inducted into Sabbat and has horrifically low humanity scores. Okay, you at least read that off the wiki. That's great. Then understand what the Sabbat is when you put it in the book that has V5 attached to it, your name, and a legacy before you that made the Sabbat.
Right.
All I'm saying, the basics aren't here, Jack. And to add, hey, Nate, what are the pack members' names?
Caliper, Lice, Honey, Manticore, and Feral. They are...
I strangely have an urge to go and tell my watchtower, Kamut, about what the Camarilla's been doing in Schomburg.
Well,
what's
Bob,
my point? It reads like a code from the Black Hand, is all I'm saying.
Right. Well, Bob, the Sabbat here are afforded an equal opportunity to shine as they are described in one sentence individually, much like none of the other characters in the game. I don't know. I mean, look, it's no secret. Like, Bob and I are fans of the Sabbat because we're fans of all of the aspects of this game. And the way that they've been treated, the way that they've been marginalized to comic relief, essentially, is unacceptable. I don't know why it's happened. I don't know what the fear or the apprehension towards exploring monstrous vampires in a game of monsters. I don't know where that comes from, but as a fan for 20 years plus of this system, I find it unacceptable. I feel like it needs to be said.
It's a massive letdown. It's an opportunity where they could have shined with some in-depth characters that I feel, and look, the number's five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. why couldn't they have been inducted in the Mithraic cult and put into torpor while Monty sat in the throne and did it for a decade,
yeah,
or 5 years, whatever it was, to some effect, or what have you, or rework the ritual where it's those five that do it, because they share a blood bond with him, and those five people are his connection. You don't need the items if these people share that love through the Viniculum, which, guess what, Camden didn't have a clue about until he was Monty Coven. And then we're in some water with enough gray area to tie to it, especially if Farrell is more than a growling woman with long matted hair wearing worn military fatigues.
Sweet.
That's all you get about her. That's all the effort you get. And to me, it's nonsense.
Yeah.
It's complete nonsense. And that's where the ball was dropped. But I find it humorous more than offensive. I'm literally like whatever. This is ridiculous. I wouldn't do it. This whole thing about his pack wasn't even thought about.
I'm not offended. I'm just really, really annoyed that they've decided to just disregard an entire portion of their fan base and make no effort to explain why. Just every interaction that the Sabbat gets is they're off somewhere in the Middle East fighting the ancients. You mean the ones that are here in London? They didn't need to go to the Middle East. They could have went here. But also, in every scenario that we see them in V5, they're treated as, well, I just went in and killed them all because they're stupid Sabbat. They don't mean anything. Great. Okay. Well,
so
now we know.
I got to be honest, since we're just being open, I'm just going to state, I think there's some people who were fans of Rasad who are now writers for this material that were super fans of the Camarilla and Anarch. And they always hated Sabbat players because maybe they encountered them in a wrong way. Or maybe they didn't care to learn the material but just stuck with the rumor of them and write from that perspective. An argument can be made, a strong one, that clearly the writer of this Monty's pack gave three fucks about the Sabbat and didn't care about this pack and didn't know how they worked and definitely doesn't know the Viniculum.
No.
Which is the core of the Sabbat, understanding their ritual. And it's strange to me how in a book that focuses on Mithraic order and cultism wouldn't get the sect that brought that cult and rites to you at least the head nod it deserves.
Right.
And that's what it is. You can get more from it. Well, we could be here all day at that point.
Yeah. And then to top it off, the icing on the cake is just Mithras, who is returned to power and kills them. They're just setting pieces. That
it's Mithras himself. Nate, I remember you asked me, and I couldn't stop laughing ever since you said it.
Mm-hmm.
You said, what freaking point did Mithras glow like the sun?
Oh my god.
When did that ever happen? Where is this coming from? And then it's like, it's a flashback. You said, where is that? It's an amalgam power that only Mithras has. Remember, amalgams are basically, folks, what they call combo disciplines in V5. Right? It's an amalgam. It's two or more disciplines that make a unique power. That's what he has. It's an effect much like the Methuselah Mikhail, or Michael, in Constantinople, how he looked like a mosaic stained glass angel.
Right.
This is the same effect they're hammering home, because, for whatever reason, they felt it wasn't enough to describe the charisma of Mithras. Apparently, they never read about New York's prince, or excuse me, Washington, D.C.'s prince.
Right.
Right?
It's funny you mentioned that, because it's what it made me think of.
Right. Well, it's what it should have made you think of. Right? That if you're within the presence of a fourth gen, there should be a power felt, especially with the centuries added on. And it shouldn't be so strange. That's without them doing anything. You should be sitting near them, and you should be afraid.
Yeah.
That's the point. There should be awe, fear, jealousy, all that in one, because you were at the foot of, no less, that was a prince, right? That was a badass venture fake that was a La Sombra in D.C., and he made you feel the sky was falling if he was anywhere near the room, and he didn't lift a finger to do that. Now, here we have Mithras. It makes sense that if I'm kneeling at the foot of Mithras, that I should look at him in reverence and feel safe and comforting and a sense of warmth beaming from him because I drank the Kool-Aid.
Right. I'm in his cult.
I drank the Kool-Aid. So that should be hammered home. Not enough. Instead, we're going to make an amalgam power where he radiates the sun and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And we'll throw it in there. And to me, it was too much. It was like, okay. All right. I guess you needed it, and there it is.
No, but Brad checked out.
I tore apart this book. I looked up everything. Where the hell did he gold like the what's the make? And I was like, oh, it's amalgam power. Okay.
Yeah. No, I had to search too. I was like, I haven't read every single book. We all know that. We haven't reviewed London by Night. It takes place in the Victorian era. Maybe that's where it came from. I don't know. But I was like, I've never heard of Mithras being able to radiate white hot light like the sun. That's crazy. That's where I just kind of was like, all right, I'm going to put the book down for the day. I'm going to come back later.
What I did like was the sheriffs of London.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
Their sheriffs were awesome. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot about them. It's just writing what their personalities were like in a paragraph. More than enough. Thought it did cool.
Yeah.
Their head harpy, Violet Mary, definitely worth a read to understand how a Nosferatu can be a very successful harpy. Regina Blake, of course, is Ashes Chilled. The heralds in here, I mean, they have a cavalcade of people to go along to make that city flush out for you to tell how they would and add your own stats to it.
Right. Even if you don't go with the story.
Right. And I applaud that. I think that's awesome that they include it in here. However, Jessicar, Juliet, Parr, and Hafsa, the Archon, who was formerly the actual Archon of...
Madame Guile. Or Madame Guy, yes. Depending on your
Madame
personal preference.
The guillotine, Madame Guile. Now, what's interesting about this is that Hafsa's in the city for whatever reason.
Because Archon.
Right. I couldn't figure it out. I was waiting for that shoe. Just watching events from afar, just seeing what's going on.
Just Archon. Just hanging out.
It's interesting, right?
Yeah, and then, I'll give you that. It's interesting.
Juliet Parr comes in because here's the thing.
Yeah.
I read something that I feel that impassioned when you told me originally was a different take. And they do back up and justify why Justicar's here. Because one of the Occam states, what happened? Like, everyone's in fear of what happens at the end of London, right?
Right.
Because the power grab is real. After all these Elysia are hit and people are staked and taken out and, hunters are swarming over known Elysia, everyone goes to ground or leaves.
Right.
That's what's going on. It's you stay, you die.
Right.
And Queen Anne's in the wind and everyone's in the wind. No one knows what's going on. In reality, that's what Mithras wanted the entire time. Because it's the lay of the stage for his comeback. And so we'll go with that scenario. For Mithras to come back, that has to happen. And that's one of the points. However, what he didn't want was the Camarilla because he didn't want the attention that would bring. And right. They are here.
Right.
So it's like a final FU from Valerius. Because as he's coming back, here's Juliet Parr. Why I like this is because this is written to state there are consequences. Steep consequences. It's awesome. You're a badass Methuselah from the Moulin Rouge back in the day. Right? Whatever.
Right.
And you're here and you're living it up and you get back your godhood, and...
Right.
Whatever. And as you come through, you smoke the antigen group, which I found funny. Right? Because Mithras, it's a scene they write where it says, if you side with Mithras and he's back and he's his full power, he now radiates like the sun and he sees, he's with Roger de Camden in his new body and he's Thomas, whatever, and he sees down below that the hunters are there. He immediately, faster than the eye can ever pick up, he's down there and he's killing and murdering Antigen with ease and impunity. And the Sabbat Pack dives into the war. And then you, the players, run or don't. Depending. Right. But Mithras goes through and at the end of it, he says, Mithras is unfazed, but all these guys are dead. And then he turns and smokes all the Sabbat who weren't dead.
Right.
And he's like, aha, I am all that is man. And, he's really good of himself. And he's like, well, are you with me or not? And if the players say, yes, come with me, retire to Edinburgh, where we'll relax and we'll watch London and we'll regrow it just like we did Rome. And you disappear. Well, if you tell him, no, we're not going. We're not going with you now. Wah, wah. Deuces.
Right.
And he leaves. Right? Smuggled out the city. Well, where's Juliet Parr come in? I'm glad you asked, because I mentioned her, right? One of the things the kindred remaining in the city are sweating is the fact that, well, this sucks. This breach of the masquerade's terrible. All these leases, man, the inner circle. They're going to send the Justicars. They're going to come here and clean house. They want to know who messed up. And they're going to handle it. And yeah, you're right. They do send a Justicar. However, they also add, what elder would be crazy enough to come and enter this environment where everyone's getting smoked by hunters and do it? Well, it's called a Justicar.
Right.
They come with Archons.
Right. Yeah, my issue was the Justicars weren't present sooner when the entire city started to realize all of their web of influence started to just fail, started to be destroyed by Antigen. Also, why it screwed with me was because Parr is from London. So her influence base originates from there.
Well, I'll answer. One, careful reading would dictate the fact that the influence in London was assumed to be Mithras. The people who were losing influence, it was thought Mithras coming back. The Camarilla is aware of Mithras. And so if this dude controlled what was once Avalon, and there'd been some, we'll call it fuckfuck games going on back and forth politically, where over centuries, sometimes he's there in force and sometimes he's not. But at least they're Camarilla, right, Valerius? Thumbs up. Okay. Now, as they start losing influence this time, the assumption is Mithras dead or no? And the Camarilla never makes a move until they know all sides.
Sure.
Until they know just what they're getting into, and that's why they're feared. So if you look at it from that angle, it's a power move for the Camarilla do. You have an Archon in place who seems to be ho-hum, keeping eyes. Great. Doesn't move to help anybody dying. Doesn't move to help anybody involved. Stays out of it, in fact, for Juliet to come in. And this is where you step in as the storyteller. They laid the seeds for it. For UDST to start going, now Juliet Parr has some very difficult questions for some player characters who may have taken advantage and stuck around for the power vacuum. To come back with Queen Anne, because the Camarilla want Queen Anne reinstated as Prince of the City. Because this is clearly Mithras' doing.
Right.
Right? How would they have known of all the Elysiums? How would they have known of key rivals to Anarchs and whatnot and everything else? We certainly know Queen Anne did not destabilize her own reign.
Right. No, that's true. That's true.
Right? So when the Justicar comes back with Queen Anne and he's sitting in Edinburgh, what it is, what the story's telling you, London fell because Mithras basically smashed all his toys and left.
Right.
Right? Now he's in Edinburgh and the Camarilla comes in to rebuild it for them.
Right.
This is now officially theirs.
Yeah. It's at the conclusion. The if Mithras is in charge, he takes his place as Prince of Edinburgh, and London can go fuck itself. Basically, it's a white hot scorched earth. That's what it is. And in most circumstances, the end of this is going to be that
you're going to have people thrown down in one way or the other. So it tells you that it's not safe. Puts in the map the Second Inquisition is a threat, and blah blah blah. And I say blah 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 because the Second Inquisition isn't a threat. I'm going to state this. No group of hunters is going to be a threat to any vampiric organization. What it is vampires are now using hunters as a scapegoat to resolve most of their issues when dealing with elders. I don't have to be Anarchs running wild to risk myself running at an elder in a pack when I could tell Barney Fife and the MI6 guy in the corner that vampires are real, give him a docket and point at the address, see what happens.
Right. It's crazy.
Why wasn't it done before?
It's crazy.
What are the elders doing? In another century, they won't even remember what a vampire is again. There's enough media for it to work, right? Tell your story. And, you know, if Mithras can wake up, turn around, and lay waste to the Blade Revival and Operation Anshin, I'm willing to bet your players can wreck shop. Oh, by the way, here's an interesting thing to me, Nate. No one ever mentions this, and I'm gonna. If you were a guy hunted by mortals, like you're a vampire elder, you throw a party. You know hunters are coming.
Right.
I'd be quirky enough to tell you this is a BYOF party. Bring your own firearms. What? Bullets ain't hurting us, Jack.
Right. Right.
What do you mean? Oh, if anybody shows up and they're not the cops and I know they're on my payroll, if they show up and they won't leave with a phone call, shoot them. Really? Yeah, and it's free feeding. What? Yeah, shoot them, bring them to the door, we'll feed, have a little fun. We used to do this back in, what was it, the 14th century? But rather Bob, enjoyable.
But Bob, they're bringing in an assault chopper. What do you do with an assault chopper?
That's terrible. That's right. They're going to bring in an assault chopper domestically to lay waste. What is this, Call of Duty?
Yeah, it is. It is. But I've got one word for you that will help. I don't know. Maybe some people didn't figure it out, but it's obfuscate. I don't know. Anyways, did you have anything else humorous or interesting or entertaining that you wanted to address with this book?
I was just helping you vent a little, just a little, but also understand that ultimately my opinion, real simple, book is worth it for its portrayal of London. It's worth it for you to feel like you're in London and how to get that feeling from it. It lists shows that you could watch that showcase London. They missed one. That's all right. It's called Legend. It's amazing. Talks about the Kray twins. If you ignore even the plot and just pay attention to where they shoot it, it's beautiful. It's a great retelling to see where that's at, and it's well done. Also gives you an idea of how the underworld works there, or could work. I mean, it's a good way to see it. I also like the books referenced in here are dominant. They talk about the weird buses in London, weird to us who live in the States.
Right.
Seeing a double stack bus riding around and you hop on that to get to where you're going kind of eliminates the need, especially to how extensive their public transport is for a car. And that's what a lot of the citizens believe. So accordingly, that's awesome. My hat's off to them for that. The artwork is awesome, save for one picture, which I showed to Nate. And I won't bring up other than that. But let's just say, shame on someone.
It's oddly reminiscent of a design you might be able to find in clip art or as a bathroom shower curtain. Just going to say that. That's it. That's all.
you look up horror shower curtains, you can see what we're talking about as it relates to that. It's a common photo there. And that's not happenstance, by the way. I'm certain somebody does that before they put it in a book. But the effect's there nonetheless. I truly would have gotten this book in PDF instead. However, the PDF, why I would have got it for that is just so I could take a lot of the content in here and sort of see it as a storyboard and do that idea I was telling you about. You know, right. Just I really think PowerPoint, those photos, clips of what they had in here. And some there is some decent stuff in here that you could salvage. Just if you're trying to take it as is to be a book to tell on the mountain and brag to your friends that you own it, I don't think this is going to be it. It's going to be a filler source for the dynamic stories you're going to tell on your own that come from it. And I think that was the point of the book.
Yeah, I'll just say this as one final thought before we wrap this podcast up. If you have developed an expectation of the quality based off of, like, perhaps the material that Onyx Path has made, Chicago by Night being a prime example, I don't think you're going to find the same level of quality in this. That's as deep as I can get into that. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts and a lot of feelings about this, but that's it. It's our review. Take it or leave it. It's our opinion. Doesn't necessarily mean you have to share it. We definitely always suggest read it for yourself, develop your own opinions. Having said that, let me pose this question to you. Do you want to next review the Chicago Folios, which is the next book available for V5?
Yeah, I think we agreed to it when we said we were doing this one to knock it out because they were two new things to stay relevant.
Yep.
I also have pre-read the Chicago Folios and know they're very, very, very good. So I think that'll be... where this is sort of a neutral kind of issue book for us, I know Chicago Folios is going to be a fantastic thing to go over because it's content that they wanted to include but couldn't, had it separate, and I think it's stellar. I love the Chicago by Night V5 book, and they do amazing what the Folios do.
All right, so basically what that means is next week we're going to give you a non-review episode, something, you know, vampire-related, but not this, and then... 2 weeks, we'll review Chicago Folios, and only because I haven't read it. I was too busy reading this. The big thing about these V5 books, which is a blessing or a curse, is they're all like 250 pages. So they're not a 90-page source book, which I can pick up and read in 3 days. We got to read them. We got to consume them. It's a double book. So that's why we're taking 2 weeks. Probably be the standard for new books, but they don't come out every week, so you don't have to deal with that every week. Thank you, Bob, for joining me on this podcast. This double-sized 2-hour podcast. I had a great time reviewing the book.
I did as well. I did enjoy it.
Hopefully all of you enjoyed it as well. Thank you for listening. As always, talk to you later. Thank you for listening to 25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade. If you like our podcast and you'd like to help support our show, consider backing us at patreon.com/25 Years of Vampire the Masquerade. We offer reward tiers of additional Patreon-only podcasts, t-shirts, and personalized gaming experiences. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and go to our website, utilitymuffinlabs.com, for links to all of our social media, additional podcasts, and more. If you'd like to chat with us, submit a title for review, promote your gaming-related stuff, or anything else you can think of, email me at nathan@utilitymuffinlabs.com. Utility Muffin Labs, consistently rated adequate.